Well, welcome everyone. It's cold and frosty outside, but we're going to have an excellent opportunity to discuss the future of Europe. I'm really grateful that Nathalie Tocci has chosen to come back to her alma mater, can we say, given that she had her PhD here.
And my master's.
Exactly. Yes, and the master as well. So I'm very grateful that you came back to talk about your new book, A Green and Global Europe. Nathalie is the director of the Istituto Affari Internazionali, Institute for International Affairs in Rome, and is also a honorary professor, University of Tübingen, but has also a policy side, so I think that you're going to cover it all, can we say that? And then we have Professor Robert Faulkner, Department of International Relations, and a bit the Grantham Institute, shall we say, who is going to act as a discussant to get us started with our discussion. And I am Federica Vicky, also in the Department of International Relations, and I'm going to moderate the Q&A, and I will be looking forward to your good questions and comments for Nathalie. But shall we get started, Nathalie?
Well, firstly, thank you so much, Federica, for organising this. Thank you, Robert, for being here. And thanks to all of you. I know that this is your last day of term. So honestly, you should be out drinking. And here you are listening to me for the next hour and a bit. So let me perhaps spend not too much, but half an hour or so telling you a little bit about the story of this book. And perhaps before I start, tell you really why I wrote it. Hey, Karina. Federica was sort of saying, you know, sort of I am someone that in many respects is in between different worlds. I have an academic background, but I'm not an academic. I've had policy experience. I was special advisor to two high representatives, Federica Mogherini and then Josep Borrell. And I've also, and this is kind of more recent, and here I have two of my colleagues sitting there, have been on the board of energy companies recently, ENI. And this book is kind of related to all of this. So I consider myself someone to really sort of hop in between different fields. Now, for a long while, I kind of thought that what I was studying and learning, because in order to obviously make a contribution to a board, you obviously try and kind of study quite a bit. Somehow, this is something that I shouldn't be talking about or writing about. And then it was only last year, when I was doing a visiting professorship at the Kennedy School in Harvard, that I sort of decided that was a really silly, artificial distinction that I'd kind of made in my own mind, and that actually I should be writing about all this. And of course, this was happening at the time in which there was a lot of excitement building up to COP26 in Glasgow. And I really felt that, you know, sort of what I'd been thinking about and kind of, you know, sort of working on over the years, it was really the time to try and put it into a story. And of course, it's a story that is not related, obviously, to my board experience. It's kind of related to my background as an academic and as a policy person. So what is the story of the book? It really starts from two rather basic premises. Premise number one, the European Union has really gone through what many have defined as a perma-crisis for really the best part of the last, you know, 15 years or so. The constitutional crisis in 2005, the Eurozone crisis beginning in 2008, the migration crisis in 2015, Brexit, of course, the pandemic, then the war. It has literally sort of hopped from one existential crisis to the next. And as it did, especially in those first three crises, constitutional crisis, Eurozone, and migration, it really kind of felt like it had lost its mojo. It didn't really have a compelling story to tell, and it particularly didn't have a compelling story to tell to younger generations. Now, especially over the last 2-3 years, I would say, it's found that story once again. And it's really a story about the green, you know, the transition, the energy transition. And hence the cover of the book, which is really all about the fact that the EU's flag is in many ways really being painted in green now. Now, why is it that a green Europe is, in a sense, the way in which the EU can and should rediscover its story, its narrative once again? Sort of a set of fairly obvious reasons. Reason number one, obviously, climate, you know, the climate crisis is an existential crisis. So whether you're Europe or whether you're the rest of the world, it is really the defining challenge of our age. Reason number two, the green transition is an economic growth strategy. And of course, especially if one thinks about everything that happened since the Eurozone crisis, all of a sudden, Europe was no longer associated with prosperity, with opportunity, with growth. It started, you know, being associated with a number of other things like inequality and austerity. And so the idea that through the transition, the EU could actually reimagine itself and reimagine itself as a growth project was a second sort of key reason why a Green Europe is so important. Third reason really has to do with politics and sort of re-engaging citizens and particularly, as I said, younger generations for whom the climate crisis is the most important challenge to face. And again, particularly coming after years in which all of a sudden, Brussels was viewed as being distant, detached from the needs, the desires of ordinary citizens. Again, the Green Europe was a way to recapture the imagination, the passion, in a sense, of citizens, beginning with youth. And then, perhaps more recently, particularly since the war in Ukraine, all of a sudden, the transition and Europe's energy transition also becomes a security strategy. And it sort of, the strategic element of energy security through the energy transition is something which, of course, emerges in full force since Russia's invasion of Ukraine. So premise number one of this book, this is really what we should be doing. For all of these reasons, this is really the EU's project for the next decades ahead. Premise number two of the book, this transition will happen. And this is kind of a fact. And it's a fact because, of course, it's not the first transition that has happened. The world has been going through many transitions over the centuries. There was the transition from wood to coal, from coal to oil. There will be the transition away from fossil fuels. And there will be a transition away from fossil fuels simply because this is the way in which markets will be going. It's the way in which technology will be going. It will just make economic sense to transition away from fossil fuels in the way, in the same way as which there have been other transitions in the past. Now, the snag is, and the difference between this transition and previous transitions, is that this transition is, in a sense, determined not only by market forces and by technology, but it's essentially being driven by the awareness that either we transition away from fossil fuels or we fry, right? So inevitably, it needs to happen in a much, much shorter time frame compared to those previous transitions that took place over the course of mostly several centuries. So given that it has to take place in a much shorter time frame, and given, of course, that the complexity of the world is much greater compared to previous centuries, it essentially is a transition that, unlike previous transitions, has to be driven essentially by policy. It cannot only be driven by market forces and by technology. So on the basis of those two premises, what's the argument? What's the story of the book? Essentially, what the book does, and of course, I'm not an energy or a climate expert. I'm a kind of, you know, IR person and an expert on Europe. So in a sense, I'm looking less at the specific energy and climate technical dimensions of the transition. But basically, what I'm saying is that given that we need to do it, But given that it has to be policy driven, what we need to make sure is that we don't only do it by looking at it through the lens of energy and climate, but we need to account for what are the possible implications, the consequences of the transition, looking at it from a social, economic, political, and geopolitical lens. Why? Well, because if we don't do so, either we're not going to do it on time, or we are going to do it, but the backlash that there could be in terms of those social, economic, political, and geopolitical implications could basically bounce back and sort of hit the union in its face. So having said that, what are those possible implications, and how is it that the European Union should be addressing them? And what the book does is essentially it sort of breaks down that question into three steps. So it's looking at it firstly, internally. So what are the internal socioeconomic and political consequences of the transition, and how is it that we should be addressing them? What are the regional implications, particularly looking at our neighborhood, both to the south and to the east? And then kind of going up a level, looking at the global level, and essentially, again, looking at what are the implications of the transition, looking at it in that broader sort of global level, and how is it that the European Union should be addressing it. So beginning with the internal. So essentially here, the main point really is that, yes, whereas it is true that growth and emissions can be decoupled, and that therefore, as I said, the energy transition is and can be a growth strategy, that doesn't mean that inequalities will not rise. And in fact, there is a very real risk that if left sort of unchecked, if just left to markets and technology, those inequalities will rise. And they will rise not only between member states, but they will also rise within member states. And so there is a real risk that in precisely the same way as previous crises, like the Eurozone crisis or like the migration crisis, which spurred nationalist populism and Euroscepticism, which of course was the real cancer that really risked tearing the Union apart, if not handled well, the energy transition could have exactly those kind of effects. And of course, one only needs to kind of, you know, rewind back, was it 3 years ago, when the Gilets Jaunes demonstrations paralyzed France. Now, of course, the Gilets Jaunes demonstrations were not Eurosceptic in nature, but one only needs to think about how now that the EU, far more than in 2019, when the Gilets Jaunes protests took place, now it's the European Union that is associated with climate policies, with the energy transitions. And if that kind of link were to be made, transition equals inequality equals the European Union, you could see basically the same extremely sort of counterproductive effects taking place. So what is it that we should be doing about all this? Well, to an extent, things that we are already thinking about, or that the European Union is already thinking about. It is already a fact that the European Union is has established already a just transition fund, a climate social fund, with the former essentially looking at the aspect of inequalities between member states, the latter looking at more the question of inequalities within member states. And yet, if you actually look at the quantities that are really being discussed, this is basically peanuts. So if you take the Just Transition Fund, we're basically talking about something in the order of 17 billion over the course of 7 years. This is the duration, as you know, of the multi-annual financial framework. If you look at the European Climate Social Fund, you're basically looking at something slightly bigger. We're talking about something in the order of 40 or perhaps even 50 billion. So slightly more encouraging, again, over 7 years. But then you take take the comparison and you take actually what has happened over the last year. So over the last year, between September 2021 and October 2022, the European Union and its member states spent over half a trillion in one year on the energy crisis. Whether this is, you know, investments on new infrastructure, whether it's mainly sort of meeting the needs of citizens and consumers by essentially subsidizing utility bills, which, if you think of it, is indirectly a subsidy to fossil fuels itself. But if you think of the order of magnitude, in one year, the crisis, the energy crisis, has meant spending over half a trillion in one year. And, you know, sort of adding European Climate Social Fund, Just Transition Fund, we're talking about maybe 60, 70 billion over 7 years. So yes, the idea is right, the quantity is completely wrong. Second sort of set of questions is really everything that falls in that neighborhood department. And when I was kind of thinking about it, it wasn't really easy to make sense of it, because actually if you think about what are the political and the geopolitical and the security implications of the transition on the neighborhood, you really do need to unpack that neighborhood in its kind of different components, particularly as they relate to the energy transition and to the energy relationship with the European Union itself. So basically, sort of, let me run you down these different categories. You have fossil fuel producing states that are heavily dependent on their exports to the European Union, and they are also actually rather fragile states. So just to clarify what I mean, I don't really worry about countries like the United Arab Emirates or Qatar. It is clear that even as we move into the transition, they have sufficient fiscal space to manage to diversify at some point when they're going to be forced to do so. I worry far more about countries like Nigeria, or a country with vis-a-vis whom we're actually increasing our dependence quite significantly, like Algeria, perhaps even Azerbaijan, although Azerbaijan, I think, fits in a category that is in between, in a sense, the UAE and Algeria. But if you take countries like Nigeria, like Algeria, these are extremely fragile countries that are heavily dependent on their exports to the EU. At the moment, they're even increasing their fossil fuel exports to the European Union. What happens in the next 20, 30 years when we reduce that dependence? They're not going to be selling that oil and gas elsewhere. What are the political, the economic, the social, and the security implications, basically? And how are those going to affect the European Union itself? So what to do about that category of countries? Well, there the argument really is that what we should be doing is progressively greening our energy relationships with these countries. So yes, very clearly, let's just take the example of Algeria. Yes, very clearly, inevitably, there's an important gas sort of side to the story these days, especially as we wean ourselves off from Russian gas. But what we should be doing as we sign these new contracts is embedding within these relationships European investments in carbon capture and storage, European investments in renewables, and making sure that as the years go on, the share, in a sense, of those, in a sense, blue or green investments actually increase over time. And therefore enabling these countries to transition as we, you know, to transition with us, rather than leaving them essentially with the fragilities that they will have to deal with. So that's kind of one category of countries. Second category of countries is, you know, countries like, well, basically, it's Russia. But you could make the argument, although it's kind of peanuts in comparison, you can make the argument to an extent also about Azerbaijan. So basically, you know, countries that essentially weaponize their interdependence or their dependence with the European Union. I say you could, you know, sort of at a stretch also make the argument for Azerbaijan. Of course, there's nothing in comparison, although if you think of it, it's really quite disturbing, I would say, the way in which, as the EU's dependence on Azerbaijan in this context is increasing, and you know, you see Commission President von der Leyen going to Baku, Azerbaijan doesn't exactly kind of hold back in terms of moving forward on its kind of full sort of reconquering of Nagorno-Karabakh and surrounding regions. But of course, as I said, the main story there is really a Russia story. So very clearly, as we transition away from fossil fuels, it's almost automatic, right, that weaponizable relationships no longer exist. I'll be very honest with you. When I started writing this book, of course, this was before Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And in the first drafts, here I was basically putting Russia in that first category of countries. So basically saying this is a country, you know, vis-a-vis whom it's the EU that over time will need to assist Russia itself in its decarbonization journey. And this is something that obviously would have been in Russia's interest. I would have argued that it would have been even in the EU's interest, in the sense that, you know, where are we going to put all those wind farms, right? I mean, you kind of need the space in many ways that Europe does not have. Now, of course, that's not an argument that you can make today. I think at some point, it is a point that will resurface in the discussion, much in the same way as, for instance, the United States says, well, you know, we compete with China on everything apart from climate. You know, on one level, that same logic should also apply between the European Union and Russia. We're clearly not there yet, but I think that is something that in the years and in the decades ahead will return on the agenda. At the moment, the Russia story is basically one of, as we wean ourselves off from Russian fossil fuels, that is something that increases, obviously, our security as well. Third category of countries are countries that actually don't export fossil fuels themselves to the European Union, but whose trade relationship with the European Union is very carbon intensive. So here, probably the most interesting example is Turkey, whose trade relationship with the EU is extremely close, and in fact, actually even belongs to the customs union with the European Union. And here you have all sort of sorts of problems which emerge as the European Union establishes and then eventually imposes what is known as a carbon border adjustment mechanism, which particularly in the case of Turkey then has, you know, on the one hand, this is a relationship which is already, in a sense, really quite problematic. It would add an extra layer of problem and complexity. In, as I said, already a fraught relationship, and added onto that the fact that it is not quite clear how you can impose a CBAM if both, you know, Turkey and the EU belong to the same customs union. Now, ideally, what we should be doing there is basically using the threat of CBAM to make CBAM not necessary. And what I mean by that is, ideally, it's that threat of CBAM and the trade disruption that it could create that should be used to act basically as an incentive for Turkey itself, or countries like Turkey, you know, themselves, to move towards carbon pricing. And so, in a sense, the real success of CBAM is a CBAM that is never actually implemented, because you don't need to implement it, because it's the threat itself that has sort of spurred countries to move forward on carbon pricing. Fourth category of countries are countries that actually don't export neither fossil fuels nor carbon-intensive products, but actually could represent incredible opportunities for a green Europe. So countries like Morocco, or countries, very interestingly, like Ukraine itself, that actually have tremendous potential in terms of you know, what a decarbonized economy could look like, and decarbonized energy sources, you know, from, in the case of Morocco, although obviously he's thinking about solar and hydrogen connected to it, in the case of Ukraine, mainly wind and the hydrogen connected to it. But basically what you see here is all of a sudden the economic map of the European neighborhood really changing as a result of the economic implications of a green and a greening Europe. And then very, very finally, it is countries, so it's not an energy transition story, but it's really a climate crisis story. So those countries in the neighborhood that are already and will suffer most from the climate crisis. And here I really pick on the one hand, countries of the Sahel, on the other hand, Iraq. And if you think of Iraq, this is really sort of a country that will both face, I mean, I didn't mention, but I should have mentioned Iraq in the list of those fossil fuel but fragile countries. You know, the sort of double risk of the fragility that comes with the transition, but also being probably in the Middle East, the country that is most, is going to be, is already most affected by the climate crisis. Essentially, the argument there is that the EU should be increasing massively its climate adaptation funds. It does do better than most other countries when it comes to climate adaptation. It's not doing enough. So in a sense, it's a very similar argument to the one that I was making internally, that I think also applies externally. Now, very briefly, because I'm starting to talk a little bit too much, but very briefly on that global, final global step of the argument. And there, basically, I would say that the, I think the sort of the big story is really one which says, well, a fossil fuel world was one in which power in the energy sphere did not quite equate with power in international politics. What I mean by that is, yes, Saudi Arabia is an important country, but it's not that important. In a decarbonized world and a decarbonizing world, where basically in that decarbonized economy, you basically see value moving down the value chain, it is essentially, it's the big guys that really will hold power in that, you know, so it's the countries that will have most power in the international system that are also going to be the big players in energy terms. So basically it's going to be China, the United States, and Europe. Because the innovation, the technology, the role of, you know, sort of technology and innovation in a decarbonized world is far greater than the role that innovation and technology play in a fossil fuel world. Now, all of this, of course, is kind of playing out at a time, as we know, in which there is growing tension within that international system. We don't quite know whether we're slipping into a new form of bipolarity, but this is, of course, a big part of what the IR debate these days is all about. And so the way in which, on the one hand, US and China in that competition interlocks basically with the energy transition, and you only need to look at the Inflation Reduction Act to get the point. I mean, what's fascinating about this is that the United States is doing the right thing for the wrong reasons. I mean, it's putting a lot of money, far more than we are at the moment, on the energy transition. And it's doing so, in all fairness, not really because of climate. It's doing it mainly because it has China in mind. So it is doing, in a sense, the right thing, as I said, for the wrong reason. But it kind of goes to show, I mean, the IRI really goes to show this kind of interlocking of the energy transition with international politics. And the way in which the EU, in a sense, sits in between and how it handles it, and all of the dilemmas that this raises, and just let me kind of mention a couple. I think there's a big set of issues which is really about transatlantic relations. I mean, the IRI is, on the one hand, something that I think kind of crystallizes, captures it very clearly, where basically you have both the EU and the United States that understand that there has to be in a sense, price signal in order to incentivize the transition. The EU goes about it in terms of carbon pricing. The US goes about it in terms of subsidy. In principle, both kind of make sense. But of course, if the EU does one thing and the US does the opposite thing, the consequence is the deindustrialization of Europe. And so how are we going to deal with that transatlantically? I think a whole other set of dilemmas really has to do with our relationship with China. So on the one hand, we know that there is a real risk of new dependencies emerging. Of course, the big debate here about critical minerals really comes to mind. But I would say more broadly, you know, what are the dilemmas that we're going to be facing in our relationship with China, where it is not going to be, in a sense, the old story of is it interest or is it values that prevails, but at times very different sets of values or very different norms that we're trying to pursue. So in the case of China, what do we do? Do we import Chinese solar panels or do we not? Well, we don't want to, looking at it from a human rights perspective, very problematic. We know where those solar panels are being produced, and we know the whole sort of, you know, dilemma surrounding forced labor in Xinjiang. And yet if we don't import those solar panels from China, we will not meet our 2030 targets on renewables. For all of the investment that we can and we should be doing now, they're ahead of the game. And so we're simply not going to meet those targets in time. So you basically have a real dilemma, which is all about different sets of values competing, rather than, in a sense, kind of rather traditional debates of, you know, interests versus values. And then very finally, and this kind of came out very forcefully at COP27, the relationship with the global south, for lack of a better term, and everything that has to be done in terms of climate finance, you know, that new kind of cleavage which is emerging again in the international system and the way in which countries like China actually use it to their benefit, again, for reasons that have absolutely nothing to do with energy and climate. So to wrap up in what has been a far too long presentation, let me just kind of conclude by saying, so what's the bottom line in all of this? And in particular, what's the bottom line in policy and in institutional terms? And you know, the sort of the conclusion is, in a sense, rather simple. If, on the one hand, this is what we should be doing, and if these are all the potential problems which will emerge if we don't do it right, this is something that really has to be put at the center of what Europe, European countries, European institutions do. I would say that at the moment, it's beginning to move in that direction, but mainly, you know, you just think about the fact that you have a commission which has said, this is what I want to do. The first vice president of the commission is also the one that is responsible for climate. So I would say, you know, that there is the beginning of this journey, but I don't think that we're at a place now in which you have climate and the transition being at the core of what finance ministries do, foreign ministries do. You know, you can literally go down the list of different institutions and different policy areas. And if we're serious about all of this, because otherwise these are the consequences, it really should be at the core of each one of these policy sectors. So in a sense, the kind of, you know, the conclusion to all of this is rather simpler, and I go through a sort of set of examples of how this could be done. But as I said, the real bottom line in all of this is that if it has to be, and it should be, a green Europe, it should be a global Europe too. And I'll stop there.
Thank you, Natalie. Plenty of topics, issues to discuss. Robert, get us started.
Shall I use the microphone, perhaps?
We should have it in room.
You think so?
Ooh.
All right. Yeah, can you hear me from here?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Good. All right. Good.
But it's the Marshall Building.
New building. Well,
technologically advanced.
Now, I've taught here when the air conditioning didn't work, so I'm a bit skeptical. Anyway, well, where do you go after this riveting talk with a discuss and comment? Perhaps first of all to say, when Federica asked me if I wanted to comment on on this new book by Natalie, I didn't hesitate at all, and I agreed to do it because I knew this is going to be a fascinating book to read, and I've read it front to back. And it's going to be providing the kind of insights into how the European Union is going about the green transition in a way that only Natalie can deliver, because she's one of Europe's leading thinkers about European foreign policy, but she's also a practitioner because of her advisory role in Brussels. So I think the combination of those two backgrounds that Natalie has are tremendously valuable, and this book shows for it. To be honest, it's an absolute cracker, and if you haven't got it on your Christmas reading list yet, if there's still space for your Christmas reading list, then you should add it to that. When the book arrived, however, I had a look at it, and it's a very sort of European book cover, although published in the UK. And if you take away Natalie's name, if you just look at that sort of cover, I'm not sure I would have picked it up immediately. I have far too many books that are called Social Europe, Technology Europe, Global Europe. There are too many books, particularly in the green space, written by European authors about Europe's role in the environmental space, that feel a bit self-congratulatory, that feel very smug about Europe invented environmentalism, we're showing the world how to do this, and so on. And one gets tired. I'm from Germany, and perhaps Germans have a particular habit of writing in that style. So perhaps I'm slightly affected by that. So to be honest, I had some reservation when I saw the book cover, because it just felt like the usual output from Europe about how well we're doing in this space and how the world needs to learn from us. Except this book isn't at all like that. If anything, it's a deeply analytical take on why Europe isn't doing enough in that space and what it needs to do more. One, but also it shows us that there are important ways in which we need to rethink Europe's approach to the green transition, the net zero transition. So I take back all the hesitation that I may have had at some point when the book arrived. What I want to highlight is three things. I'll highlight two of the big intellectual contributions and shifts that I think the book makes to the debate. And then in the third point, I'll highlight a few points where I think the book could have gone a little bit deeper, but that may be the next book delivering on that front. So let me pull out what I think are the, for me at least, the really eye-opening and kind of almost agenda-setting insights that the book produces. And then I'll come to some critical perspectives. So the first point is that, as Natalie just explained, that we need to think of the net zero transition as an essentially global effort and a global race. And this is important to remember because in the Paris Agreement from 2015, where we shifted towards a more, as some people would call it, a bottom-up, nationally determined effort, where it was essentially agreed that nations would choose their own path towards decarbonisation, we've kind of lost the perspective that every major economy's choice about that transition is embedded in a wider global context. And Natalie's book brings that out beautifully and reminds us that we must never forget about that global context. There are three arguments that she makes, and I think they're worth repeating in that context. The first argument is that the transition that we are embarking on in the energy system, in the industrial system, is essentially embedded in the next story of the global economy. The future global economy is going to be a transformed economy. It will be a low-carbon economy. Now, that's not going to happen overnight. It's not going to happen in an even process. This, therefore, creates a lot of tension, conflict, but also new forms of collaboration. So to think about the future global economy, you have to understand the magnitude of that transition that we're embarking on and what it does to that global economy. It will be a profoundly transformed global economy. That creates opportunities for industrial cooperation. It creates threats in terms of competition, in terms of protectionist measures that are likely to come to the fore as different countries struggle with the competitive challenges that transition produces. You mentioned the United States in that context, the IRA, that has now produced a kind of a $300 billion plus investment program That's going to create tension, and we know how the European Union is already trying to deal with that. Second point, the net zero transition changes the competitive advantage of those countries that are currently benefiting from our fossil fuel-based industrial system. And again, Natalie has brought that up very clearly, but this is a huge challenge for us. And for our net zero transition in Europe to succeed, we need to think about those countries that you've talked about, the Arab countries, North African countries, but also countries like Russia, to some extent, the United States as well, that are benefiting currently from the fossil fuel regime. Their success will help us, their failure will endanger our net zero transition. So it's important, it's imperative that we move in some kind of uniform way and help those countries. I won't go into the different categories that Natalie very helpfully identified, but that speaks to this imperative that Europe thinks about its neighbourhoods and countries further afield. And then thirdly, the point that you raised at the end, there's a deeply geopolitical dimension to the net zero transition. Again, something that the Paris Agreement doesn't really bring out clearly. We mustn't forget that there are still two powers out there that are the number one and number two global emitters, that's China and the United States. And both these countries are going to shape future global politics and the future global economy, undoubtedly. Europe is, if anything, is on a, take this in the most benign way, on a declining path, because as its emissions are declining, its negative power in climate politics is also declining. And great power status in climate politics, ironically, is determined by the emissions that a country produces. The big polluters are those big veto powers that call the shots in global climate politics. So the problem for the European Union is here that, of course, it's seeing its influence decline as the other big emitters, China, the United States, increasingly perhaps Indonesia, Brazil to some extent, that hold carbon assets, both positive and negative ones, gain in influence. And so we need to think about how that geopolitical rivalry between the US and China, as you mentioned, plays into our global net zero and European net zero transition. And that's deeply problematic because I think we are in for an increasingly bipolar world. Some people now talk about the second Cold War that's arising between the US and China. The shift from Trump to Biden has not shifted US foreign policy towards China one bit. If anything, you could argue that Trump was perhaps more amenable towards accommodation with China because he approached the relationship in a more transactional way. Under Biden, we've seen a hardening of positions where the relationship is determined to be one of competition and enmity, and decoupling is driven ever further. So that creates challenges for the European Union. Where do we have voice in this relationship? How do we continue to seek to influence China when the strategic space for that is narrowing? And how do we maintain an independent course in that kind of environment? I think those are the key challenges that we need to face, and then that's what the book brings out beautifully. This is the agenda for the next 10 years, in other words. The second big contribution that the book makes, in my view at least, is that it shows that the European Union really needs to redefine climate policy as foreign climate policy. The transition isn't just an industrial challenge for us in Europe, it's a challenge for European foreign policy. And we need to take this much, much more seriously. You've talked about how some of the institutions of the EU are not really signed up to this, and I think that needs to be built up. Climate policy is about trade policy, it's about investment policy, it's about technology policy, it's about all those foreign dimensions that we are familiar with. The key insight, therefore, is that it's all about how well the EU does that foreign policy piece in the green transition. So this becomes a story about how strong the EU is on the foreign policy front, full stop. And we could have a long debate about that.
It's rather depressing.
Well, things to say about that. So because we depend on other countries' success, so we need to nurture that success, we suffer when other countries fail in their transition. You talked about the need to help those countries, both on the mitigation and the adaptation front. I think this is an important wake-up call, therefore, for us in Europe to think this through. It will be easy to craft a common foreign policy in this area. Different European countries have different interests towards different parts of the neighbourhood. We we've seen in COP27, the European Union played a positive role in pushing forward the idea of a loss and damage fund, but there's still some resistance when it comes to the magnitude of the funding challenge that this poses. So I think we haven't quite worked out how we're going to approach this. We're making the right signs, we're making the right moves, but this is still progress in the making. If anything, we've only just begun that kind of conversation in Europe, and you could argue the economic, the political environment for that kind of step forward isn't the right one. I mean, the Ukraine crisis, the fiscal crisis in many countries isn't making that very easy. But I think it's clear that if we don't get this right, then our own transition will fail, because we've lost the neighborhood, we've lost the wider external environment. And that is, I think, one of the key takeaways from this book. My last point is not so much a critical point, but really more a kind of a question to Natalie about the sort of the shortcomings that you see in the European Union in this regard. Because I took notes of all the challenges that we face in making this happen. And I could easily come up with four, five, six of those challenges that we need to address. Some of them, and actually pretty much all of them, are mentioned, though not analysed in some length. The first of all is the usual question in European foreign policy about maintaining unity. Can we pull all the major European powers in the same direction, from Poland to Portugal, from Germany to Italy? The Ukraine crisis has clearly brought out some different perspectives there. How will we manage that kind of that unified voice? How do we create that unified voice when the net zero transition will be difficult enough for us to organize, let alone then project into foreign policy dimension? How do we deal, you've talked about this in your talk, with the winners and losers, particularly the losers within the more deprived parts of Europe? How is it possible to create a green identity for Europe when large parts of society will see that as a threat that runs very much counter to their own interests and identity within Europe? I'd like to see that green identity come to the fore. I'm not convinced how you construct that identity so that it really unites all. One of the reasons why the European Union perhaps is faltering in the many crises that we've seen is because the old identity that we're in this together, both for peace but also for prosperity, that's no longer catching on because of the many left behinds. How is the green identity going to reshape that? I would have loved to hear more about that. Then the Ukraine crisis brought out the urgency of the energy independence agenda and the energy security agenda. Again, Europe hasn't done that much on energy. I think your book is clear about that. But what can we do to bring about that common energy framework? And then finally, perhaps something that hasn't been approached in the book is, do we need to also rethink Europe's foreign policy culture somewhat, particularly in the way we present ourselves to the outside world? Is there not a danger that as we adopt a green identity, that we leave behind the world much more sort of on the identity front? There is always a danger that we adopt a great deal of hubris and as I said at the beginning, assume that Europe is racing ahead where the rest needs to follow. I'm reminded of Borrell's recent comments about gardens and jungles. And when you go to COPs and other such meetings, you do get a sense that the world looks on European debates with some astonishment as to the incredible amounts of confidence that we've developed in this continent, when we still have a long way to travel on that transition. So I wonder whether it takes much more introspection for us to get ready for that journey. And that may be perhaps your next book that you'll be developing on this theme. Anyway, terrific book. Read it all and go and buy it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Natalie, do you want to have a quick response?
Yeah.
And then we open to Q&A and comments?
Absolutely. Well, firstly, Robert, thank you. That was absolutely fantastic. And indeed, three sets of issues that you were raising there at the end are things that I've been thinking about quite a bit, especially since the book came out. So on that, let me start with that, the final point. point, you know, sort of the foreign policy culture point, I think there's a real risk. I mean, I think there's a real risk of, you know, that there won't be a green Europe in a brown world. And if we indeed sort of charge ahead with our way of doing things and don't accept the fact that there will be different paces and different forms, and understand how we can help those different paces and different forms, then you get into all the problems that I kind of go through in the book. And that does require, I think, a change of a foreign policy culture in at least two ways. Firstly, and the obvious point, we obviously need to be a lot more proactive. Okay, that's in a sense one side of the story. The second part of the story is that we need to be less self-absorbed and understand that, you know, and then, you know, you mentioned hubris. I think that's exactly it. You know, sort of there's this understanding that our way, our standards, our way of doing the transition is the way. Well, maybe not. and I think that is something that where it is an old problem, but in this kind of new in this new dimension, risks being incredibly problematic. On the unity point, I mean, this is indeed, you know, sort of it's the unity. How do you deal with the losers? I think it's kind of all interconnected. And, you know, earlier in the presentation, because, of course, this is what I was emphasising in the book, I emphasised the point about funding. Now, in fairness, there's always going to be there's always going to be a limit to how much EU funding there's going to be, which then raises the question of if we're going to prevent the transition from actually exacerbating those inequalities, especially between member states, this basically means we have to rethink our rules. And this gets into the discussion about the Stability and Growth Pact, which means that we need to change our debt culture, particularly the debt culture in countries like your own. So you know, I think it connects with a whole set of other issues, which are basically about kind of economic and in particular fiscal policy. And then finally, on this question of, you know, the war in Ukraine, how this kind of interlocks with the transition and with indeed the fact that the EU actually still has extremely limited competences when it comes to energy. So sort of in a new way, and also the way in which, of course, Vladimir Putin has been using all of this over the last months, I kind of look at this through the lens of resilience. So there is, as I would kind of look at it, and this is something I've kind of started working on sort of more recently, I mean, since the book came out, there is Putin's understanding of resilience and Jean Monnet's understanding of resilience. Jean Monnet never talked about resilience, but
it's often seen categorically.
Well, it's kind of, you know, this is a battle between Putin and Jean Monnet. So Putin says resilience is about pain endurance. And the authoritarian state has a higher threshold of pain endurance than the kind of weak and morally corrupt liberal democratic state, beginning obviously with European countries. And so all I need to do is, you know, turn that screw a little bit, or rather turn the tap, you know, turn off the tap, and ultimately, you know, those divisions are just going to surface, and Europe is going to collapse and cave in and lift sanctions, and we go back to the good old days in which we were just basically hooked on Russian gas. Now, Jean Monnet, of course, didn't talk about resilience, but I'll put this in resilience terms. There's, in his memoirs, this kind of wonderful citation in which he defines Europe as the sum of the solutions to the crises it will face. And here we are in a crisis. And then the question is, are we using this crisis to make those steps when it comes to energy and increasing European competences in an area in which many competences it did not have? And of course, the jury is still out. I mean, it's, you know, the jury is still out in terms of Is the EU going to be able to move forward on issues like joint procurement? Is it going to be able to decouple electricity and gas markets? I'm thinking here about the slightly more structural things, not so much the here and now, are we going to agree on the price cap? But I would say that if I were to place my bet today on whether Putin or Monnet win this one, I actually think that Jean Monnet is going to win it out. So all this to say that at the moment I tilt towards the slightly more optimistic in terms of this crisis, the Ukraine war, actually being one that we will use productively to make that further step in European integration in energy terms.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Natalie. Thank you very much, everyone, for the patience. Now I'm going to open it to questions, comments, anything. I'll just mention the fact to people standing that there are a couple of chairs that you can grab over here. I'm happy to see that. Excellent. And can you please introduce yourself so that we create a little sense of community as we go along, please?
Good afternoon. Thank you very much.
You'll have to shout.
Thank you very much for the excellent presentation. I'm Anna Hungier and I'm a former diplomat at the summer representation of Hungary to the EU, currently doing a PhD at King's on CSDP. So my question relates very much to what the professor touched upon as well, and you mentioned in your response to the professor some elements of this. So you mentioned these countries and the transition and the importance of the transition, and I was just wondering if you addressed in any way in your book how, because you mentioned that you talk a lot about what the EU should do, but do you address how the EU should address member states who are somewhat reluctant to move into this transition that is required from the EU as a whole? So how do we deal with those member states, like mine,
for instance,
who would be a bit reluctant to move ahead with this in a particularly necessary space?
Shall we connect it?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Catherine. I'm a PhD student at the International Relations Department. We've talked a lot about the trade and investment side of climate politics, which is obviously really important, but we haven't talked so much about the security and defence side. I researched the EU's peacebuilding efforts in the Sahel, which you touched on, and obviously a region heavily affected by the climate crisis, and desertification is obviously driving the conflict there. I'm wondering, Natalie, what your stance is on the extent to which we can or should securitise climate change, and should the EU be adapting its approach to CSDP, and kind of what is the military and defence role in this really good situation?
Thank you. At the very back and near the window.
I'm Christina. I'm doing a PhD in the government department about roughly the colonial entanglements and sustainable development, especially looking at South America. So yeah, I had a couple of questions. One is actually like, I see and I understand for obvious reasons why there's this focus in China, the US, but I'm also wondering about the possible role of like South America, because I find especially there's a lot of very interesting sustainable development pushes and dynamics happening there, especially it relates to like government initiatives, civil society, indigenous take up of knowledge. And then I was also wondering about the possible, or like what you see the possible like ontological implications would be for this deep transformation when, or like if it had to actually happen or if it happens. Obviously there's been this talk of pushing for a greener world for a while, but I feel like a lot of the literature on it is about how much is it actually fitting with capitalism as a mode of like understanding and treating the world, or like relating to each other, right? Or even like, is it the world that we're looking for? Is it like a total different system of like treating the earth and resources, which obviously would play in like international relations as well. So I was just wondering about like that paper, like level.
Yeah.
Thank you, Natalie.
Great. Okay, so how do you go about the reluctant member states? So I think here, of course, these are interconnected, but I think there's a political and an economic story. Now, an ideological, rather more than political and economic story. And I think the only way in which we, the route has to be that economic route. And what I mean by that is there are countries that feel that they will lose from this. And one needs to make sure that they won't. Because unless they feel that there's something in for them, they will resist, and frankly speaking, kind of rightly so, right? So it is about, let's take the famous Polish coal workers, right? So it is about, sort of ensuring that there is investment in, actually Poland has started now developing a really interesting wind industry. Now, there is still going to be a problem there, because those coal workers are not all going to become sort of engineers producing wind farms. So there's going to necessarily be an element of reskilling, but also an element of compensation that needs to be put in place. Now, that is something that, in a sense, that's the, in policy terms, that's the kind of thing that you can do. Much harder is, of course, addressing the ideological resistances. But that, I think, is something that simply will have to play itself out. So, one can only hope that as the facts prove that actually this is a win-win, if the policy recipe is right, those ideological resistances are going to diminish over time. But that's maybe rational me. but I think it's the only thing that we can do. On Catherine, on your question on the Sahel. So I think there's again, this is an area where there's a possible dilemma, in the sense that an argument that I make in the book is actually we should be very strong on kind of climate adaptation, which kind of means giving a lot of money, right? This then gets us into all sorts of other problems, which is, of course, there's a climate crisis because there's a climate crisis, but that climate crisis is exacerbated by bad governance. And so if you simply increase the amount of funds, in a sense, you kind of give a blank check, where does that leave all sorts of other issues, beginning with security issues? I haven't quite, in a sense, made up my own mind in terms of how to resolve this dilemma, because the argument would be, well, if I'm saying that climate, you could look at this as in terms of, if you like, the nexus, the security, climate, migration. But at some point, you need to ask yourself the question, in that nexus, what comes first? What is my real policy objective? And there will be trade-offs. So if you follow the argument of my book, I should be saying, well, no, you just give the money. But then coming from a security background, I see all the problems that that are involved in that. Christina, on your question, let me perhaps answer it by raising a South American example, which I think really highlights a big set of kind of big questions which are being raised by this, which is essentially, is there a risk that through the transition we flip from one form of extractionism to another form of extractionism? Chile, of course, is probably the biggest example here, and how should we therefore, in order to avoid doing this, rethink other policy areas like our trade policy? So, in the renegotiation of the EU-Chile trade agreement, Chile, that of course is a source of critical minerals, basically said, well, yes, we don't just like our lithium, we just would quite like to develop our battery industry. And the EU said, well, no, you can't. This is against our free trade agreement. And of course, basically, sort of here you have a country that basically says, you know, I want to move down that value chain because that's really where value is kind of extracted. I think if we want to avoid the mistakes that we made in the past, we really have to rethink very seriously our approach to trade. I could be, you know, there can be many other examples, but I think that that is really a sort of a key question that we should be thinking about and actually using the opportunity of the fact, you know, sort of arising from a crisis, i.e. free trade is in crisis. We are not actually signing new agreements. We're certainly not ratifying the agreements that we signed. So given that, you know, sort of the trade policy area is in any case in crisis, we'll use that as an opportunity to rethink the way in which you go about it.
Yeah, good. Thank you. I have one question over there. Nicola?
Hi, Nicola Stellini, Master of Science in Global Politics. I'm wondering, when you talk about helping Morocco and Algeria in their energy transition, why should we? Because I see three different explanations. They point towards the same answer, but I'm wondering which one you lean to, and they are for the goodness of our own art, basically, for economic advantage, or to secure a geopolitical position. Mm.
Thank you. Here at the front.
Frank Benmans, professor at Grantham Institute. I'm interested in the carbon border tax adjustment. Mm. So I haven't followed it lately. So what is the likelihood that we're going to get it? Mm. And if you think there are, in case we get the adjustment, how likely is it that it's going to work? Mm. So, and in my mind, I think there is a scenario where Europe would lose half of its basic industry mm. in this transition. How likely is that?
Mm. Robert is insisting on not one point.
No.
You're sure?
I'll wait for
this. Yeah, okay. Here at the front again.
So my name is Aristan, and I'm currently a master's student in international political economy. And I wanted to ask you about the Inflation Reduction Act.
Yeah.
So as you've mentioned, the EU Commission and Member States are currently thinking about how to respond to this act. And on the one hand, there are countries such as France that are advocating for a bi-European act. And on the other hand, there are countries such as Germany that are more cautious in general on free trade. But even those are slowly warming up to a more interventionist vision on the topic. So in this case, it seems that having a green Europe might clash with staying open and global. Mm. So realistically, do you think that Europe is going to be able to stay global and open, especially on trade, if it wants to stay green?
Yeah. Yeah. Great. Okay. So Algeria, Nicole's question. Algeria, Morocco. I would say that different stories. So Morocco is a story of, in a sense, opportunity. And it's an opportunity for them, and it's an opportunity for us. The reason why I pick on Morocco, I could have picked on other countries that have a potential for the development of a renewable industry, but I pick on Morocco specifically because I think what's interesting about Morocco is that it has an industrial base. It has a big fertilizer industry. And it needs ammonia. So it has an interest in the production of green hydrogen, not only because it has the desert and it can put solar panels and that's where it can produce its electricity, but also because it has a fertilizer industry which needs ammonia, and therefore through that, you know, through the electrolysis and the production of the green hydrogen, it is not therefore something that simply it does in order to export to us, it's something that it does for itself. And that, I think, is incredibly important because the reason why previous projects, I mean, the obvious example is the Desertec project, failed is because they didn't think about what was in it in industrial terms for the countries of the south themselves. So I think, in a sense, Morocco is really a story of this kind of double economic opportunity for both sides. Algeria is more, it's kind of in the risk mitigation department. It is basically the concern that You know, Algeria is a very fragile country. You know, sort of when the Arab uprisings sort of began, when indeed there was a transition, and you know, political transition in Algeria itself. I mean, probably no one in this room was confident that it was not going to blow up, right? And it's not as if the fundamentals have changed. It's still an extremely problematic country, and so the concern is that, as at some point we will stop buying their gas, they won't have money to pay out the subsidies, you know, and basically to cater for those social and economic policies that are probably just enough to keep the lid on the country sort of blowing up. So I think for Algeria, it's the story is really one of enabling them to move forward on their transition as a security and insurance policy, both for them as well as for us. Frank, on the CBAM question, so at the moment, I would say that although on paper the idea is still 2026, I think, frankly speaking, it's going to be delayed, at least until 2027 would be my guess, but I mean, the parliament is moving on this, but I think there will be a bit of a delay. So I think, yes, it's likely that it will happen, although with a slight time lag. I think the real question is what happens between now and then? And in particular, what happens globally in carbon markets? Already, you know, year on year, countries are moving forward on the different forms of carbon pricing. So if that acceleration continues, also spurred by the threat of CBAM, then actually CBAM would probably not be very disruptive at all. I think it's also, so it's connected to how does carbon pricing move in the rest of the world. It's also, though, connected on how the ETS market develops within the EU. Now, at the moment, and as a consequence of the war in Ukraine, it's slightly decelerated its rise. You know, a year ago, we were looking at a world in which, you know, probably, you know, sort of CO2 prices had reached basically 100, or, you know, basically reached 100 euros, and it looked like it would keep on rising. Now, you know, they're still very high. They're about, if I remember correctly, about 85 euros. But of course, it's really the risk in terms of industry, European industry, is if we increase our CO2 prices and the rest of the world does not catch up, then you have a deindustrialization kind of risk. If we slow down our rise, if other countries increase, and also if alternative forms, whether it's through regulation, whether it's through subsidies, that in the end have that same differential effect basically on prices continues, then the risk is not, it's basically mitigated. Now on the IRA question, so I'll answer the question, the internal question, but I wanted to add something that I just heard recently, which I think is interesting and I wanted to share with you, which has to do in our relationship with the United States. So indeed, internally, there is, it's always the same cleavage, though, that emerges. So you basically have member states that basically say we need to go about it in terms of more funding, and other member states that are concerned that basically this has an effect on the functioning of the free markets, whether looked at internally or whether looked at externally as well in terms of free trade. Now, my hunch is that the way in which kind of politics is going, not just in Europe but in the rest of the world, tilts towards the spending side, which gets us, though, back into this debate of different countries having different fiscal capacities to do that spending. And it's not a surprise that countries like France, I mean, Italy hasn't been very present in this debate, but it has even a greater stake than France, because it has an even a sort of smaller fiscal space to actually do the spending on its own. They have an interest in the spending happening basically at European level. But this is a big question that basically Germany will, I think, have to face. But as I said, I think it's not just related to climate. I think it's more broadly related with the way in which kind of, you know, economics and economic doctrine basically is evolving. The other sort of twist to this that I wanted though to add is, of course, a big part of the story will also depend on how the United States itself reacts. And you know, I was in a meeting recently, a couple of days ago, with several very senior members of the Biden administration. And I must say, I was extremely encouraged by the way in which, as they put it, we hear you. We understand that this is a real problem. And we really want to make sure that we do something about it. Now, the question is, given that the legislation is not going to be reopened, otherwise it would all unravel, what is it that can be done through executive orders? And one idea that came up in this meeting is basically that of, you know, the problem with the legislation as it is that it basically just specifies the fact that it's only countries that already have FTAs with the United States that can basically not be hammered by the IRA. And they're looking into adding countries that have FTAs or that are in the military alliance with the United States. So basically, this would include all NATO members and not only NATO members. Now, I don't know, because I'm not a lawyer, I don't know whether legally that can be done through an executive order, but I know that this is what the Biden administration is working on.
Thank you. I think that there was one at the front. Go ahead.
Thanks. My name's Asha. I'm a PhD student in the International Relations Department. I've wondered, what is your sense of the EU, particularly Western European nations' capacity to start having this conversation around colonialism and the fact that maybe the EU shouldn't just be doing this for the various reasons that you pointed out, but also because of the very moral reasons that they owe it to the rest of the world? You talked about EU and Chile. There's a reason that certain countries have such technological advancement. Can we start talking about tech transfer outside of market relationships with the new loss and damages fund at the COP? I'd love to hear what sort of conversations are happening, if any. Thanks.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Zenka. I'm a master's student in the European Institute. So my question is sort of, there's been a lot written about how the EU sort of derives its power from, or market power from, the strength of its internal market, and can sort of export a lot of regulations and product standards throughout the world, including environmental policy. So my question is, do you sort of agree with this, or what role does this play? And especially, what role would this sort of market power and regulatory power play in like your vision of a green
world?
Yeah. Thank you. Suchita?
Hi, I'm Suchita. I'm an MSc student at the IR department. So my question is more of like towards an ideological approach. So Ecuador was the first country to establish citizenship rights for nature, mostly as a way of protecting the environment against overexploitation of resources by MNCs. Do you see a model like that being a viable solution towards tackling climate change, or is it more of like a action that is taken for the sake of taking action? And could you see it being applied to the European context or to a larger global context?
And the very last question about you?
Ian Hyam, I'm a research officer in environmental politics at the Grantham Research Institute. And I wanted to ask a bit of a complication of the first question that was asked of you, and something I've been thinking about lately is, where you don't have policy non-alignment by member states, you don't have at least discursive ideological resistance, but you have a policy that doesn't actually align with what's going on, or it doesn't seem to. So I don't know as much about it as I'm sure you do, but in Italy you have a far right prime minister who is saying, actually, we're going to reclaim this issue. Environment is a far right issue. It's about the fatherland and protecting the nature of the fatherland. Yeah. But policy cannot do that. The market can. So don't worry, we still all the same goals, but none of the same policy. Or in Sweden, which is now saying, we're going to increase emissions in order to lower them because we need to build nuclear and stop building renewables and get rid of high-speed trains, but don't worry, that's actually how we meet the goals. essentially because the government relies on the Sweden Democrats who don't believe in climate change.
Yeah.
So in a very different example, it isn't far right, but Germany, for different reasons, is bringing coal back online, but not abandoning its policies. So what do we do with member states who are compliant in theory or in their own words, but are objectively not compliant?
That's very interesting. Let me start with that one. Well, was it the last one?
I think that, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I would say that on a whole, in Europe, there are few climate deniers, which means that the populist right, the hard right, the populist right, both, have kind of stopped using that argument as the years have kind of gone by. Some of them used to, but this was like, 7, 8 years ago, 9 years ago, now increasingly less. And so they, as you say, they try and take the climate debate and use it in different ways. And they've used it in very different ways. So those that want to keep on halting things and kind of slowing things down, indeed kind of raise the question of, landscapes and NIMBY and, all sorts of issues in that department. Interestingly, there are then those that understand that they can't, they need to appropriate that discourse and have, especially to the extent, it goes back to this issue of protectionism. To the extent that, in a sense, one can make the argument that a decarbonized world is also one which is not only more decentralized, but that actually sees a reduction in trade and interdependencies. And normally these are parties that don't like sort of many interdependencies. I don't have an answer, but I think the really interesting question is not so much how do you deal with parties that kind of appropriate it to stop it, but how do you deal with parties that appropriate it to accelerate it, but for really, really problematic reasons. Like we want to develop our renewable industry because this will enable us to stop having to buy fossil fuels from Islamic states. how do you deal with kind of, doing the right thing for the wrong reasons? I don't really have an answer to that, but I think that is the really interesting sort of, contradiction to try and unpack. So I'll kind of put together the colonialism and the MNC, the sort of Europe and multinationals and sort of that sort of set of questions. So on the colonialism point and kind of Europeans, colonialism, are we really willing to address all of this? I think you can kind of look at it as, glass half full, glass half empty. So glass half empty, very clearly, no. It's kind of not happening in those terms. It's not happening on this. It's not happening. Why is it that we are, so shocked that the rest of the world doesn't simply agree with us when it comes to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, when very clearly you could say that this is a colonial war. Well, the reason why they don't take our colonial narrative, which is, I think, the absolutely right narrative to have, but it doesn't fly when we're the ones kind of making that argument, given that we haven't kind of owned up to what our own sort of history is. And I think, sort of likewise, when it comes to the loss and damage conversation, we haven't even started talking about it in these terms. Now, if you want to look at it, though, through the lens of the glass half full, I think it's also fair to say that compared to other countries, we're certainly doing more. I mean, there was huge resistance, from the United States on the question of loss and damage. And it was really quite remarkable that actually Europeans in the end took the right side of that debate. I think that it's really quite shocking, the way in which China, you know, sort of wanted to push it, but to be on the side in which it was receiving money rather than giving money, you know, considering basically a sort of, it is the largest emitter. Yes, it's true that obviously in terms of historical emissions, but it's catching up very, very, very fast, right? So looked at in that, in sort of through that lens, you could say, well, you know, we're at least the best of a bad lot. Now, on the question, I'm not sure I really kind of got the question on, you know, Suchita's questions on multinationals, but I would say that, could you actually just quickly...
Basically, what I was asking was, would giving citizenship rights to the environmental nature, the way Ecuador has, would it actually be a viable solution to tackling climate change, and could that be applied in the European context?
That's a really good question, and I haven't thought about it. I think, you know, to be honest, I think it's probably, I'm not sure it's necessarily what it is necessary for Europeans to do internally within the EU, but I think it's far more interesting, given that the things that we're doing are moving in this direction. I think it's kind of a more interesting question to think of, you know, countries that have embarked on that journey in those ways, how is it that we should be supporting them? And this goes back to the point about there are going to be different routes to the same destination. And I think different countries, different continents, will go about it in different ways. And I think, you know, sort of, we should be humble enough, and now this kind of allows me to weave myself into the market power question. You know, we should be humble enough to, again, assume that it's not just our way which is going to be the way. And so to the extent that some countries are moving that direction, we should be looking at how to support them. On Zunke's question on market power, you know, I think that, to be honest, we can't continue just relying on this. You know, we are a shrinking market. and so we're going to continue being that market power, A, to the extent to which the way in which we set standards and regulations becomes more flexible than it was, and therefore is able to forge wider partnerships than just the European Union, which gets us into not only the transatlantic story, but the way in which we engage other global partners. But then I think the flip side to that story is not, you know, we're going to be able to do it if we actually do have an industrial base. So if we can't, you know, that market power cannot simply rely on us being a large consumer market because of that shrinking demography. So we're only going to continue being a market power if we're on not only the demand side, but the supply side. And hence the question of industry, I think, is crucial.
Well then, we're coming to an end to our allocated time. Before we finish, date for diary, 8th of March at 6:30 p.m. We're going to talk about foreign policy in the digital age. And there will be a couple of issues, especially on the technology side, that we're going to delve into. And that's going to be interesting. Watch this space. One thing I have to say, we are recording this event for future generations of students. And in general, if anyone would like the Q&A to be edited out, please let me know now. And now it's the moment to thank people that made this possible. Pumelele, Emanuele, Irene, and Alison from the Grantham Institute, and also and especially Robert and Natalie, please.
And you, Federica.